you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Happy Saturday. This is the weekend edition of the LA Report. I'm Larry Mantle, host of Air Talk. Riley Blues Boy King's life has been chronicled endlessly, but a new biography of B.B. King from journalist Daniel DeVise carefully paints a picture of his life through interviews and stories from surviving members of B.B.'s inner circle. They include managers, fellow musicians, lifelong friends, and even his ex-wife. We recently sat down with author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Daniel DeVise about his new book, King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. Extraordinary guitar and voice of the great B.B. King, King of the Blues. The Rise and Reign of B.B. King is the new biography by Daniel DeVise, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and writer. Wrote a wonderful book, Andy and Don, The Making of a Friendship in a Classic American TV Show, about Andy Griffith and Don Knotts, as well as a number of other books, including a memoir. Daniel, so good to have you with us again on Air Talk. I appreciate it. I just have to say, you know, when I interviewed B.B. King many years ago, is about as excited as I get before interviewing a guest, just someone I so admire and all. I can't imagine you immersing yourself as long as you did in his life and interviewing all the people around him that you did for this. How thrilling was this for you to get to do this project?
Well, it's a big life. He started out in the sharecropping era and was literally impoverished. I mean, he grew up in a family that had a negative, you know, net worth at the end of every year, and it's hard even to go back and get your mind around what that life must have been like. And so his story starts, you know, then, and it goes through the Depression and the war, and he was briefly in the military, and then, you know, Jim Crow and segregated race, so-called race radio. And then he broke through into the mainstream in the late 60s. And then there just were many, many more, you know, rounds that he had to go where he just sort of grabbed at these ever bigger brass rings of fame and adulation. So I had a whole extra year working on this book because of COVID. I thought I was done with it. And then COVID hit and a bunch of delays set in, and I spent a whole nother year. And honestly, I don't know if you like this book as much or better as Andy and Don, but I feel it's my best book. I spent a whole year just polishing the scenes that were the basis of the book. I try to write in scenes, and the scenes I had were that much better after that year of just delay with the COVID. So I feel like it's probably my best work.
They're so vivid. And I know this came from these conversations with people who were close to them. How enthusiastic were they or reluctant to share stories about him?
You know, it was kind of the same as with the Mayberry folks. You know, once you get embedded and you talk to a few people and they understand that you're passionate and that you love the person and that you really want to tell the whole true story, and also that you're writing something celebratory. And I don't mean like hagiography, I just mean celebratory. I mean, he's a great American. Once they get that, you know, word spreads, and I can't think of anybody who didn't talk to me. who was in his inner circle. I mean, the people really close to him. And I feel so blessed that I was able to get to these people who'd spent decades of their lives with him. And, you know, now, like I do, I've done some online book talks and had three or four of his close inner circle people there in the audience, which is just beyond humbling.
I hadn't realized that he'd lived in South Pasadena for a period.
Yeah, so that's why I reached out to you guys. I knew you'd be interested in this because when he married Sue, who was the love of his life, his second wife, in I think 58, and he said, "Well, you know, baby, where do you want to live?" Because he was a citizen of the world. He was traveling all over. So she said, "Well, L.A." So they moved and they bought a house in South Pasadena in March of 1959. Now, BB himself didn't. I mean, he lived there and he spent like the winter weeks there. And he would play at the 5-4 Ballroom in South Central and do kind of like a residency there. And they were there until he and Sue divorced in 66. And then, as I was saying, she remained the love of his life. So they remained in touch and in close touch. And Sue still lives half of her time in L.A. She's probably listening to the show now.
That's great.
She likes your show. And so the other thing is, there's a bit of history here that's not really been told. I mean, only very insider people would know this. And it's about the first gigs he did for white audiences, basically.
Yeah. And so share with us how he made this switch, because, you know, historically blues artists were playing in, you know, very small clubs and playing in the Black South in many cases, or after the Great Migration, you know, playing in Black neighborhoods of cities like Detroit and Chicago and the like. How does he cross over?
Yeah, so the Chitlin Circuit, I gather, was, you know, really a national network of just clubs in every city. I think the 5-4 Ballroom in South Central was one that, you know, where Black artists played to Black patrons, and only Black patrons usually were allowed in the clubs. And by the same token, Black patrons were absolutely excluded from most white clubs. And this endured, you know, into the late 60s. So BB had not really played for white audiences. People closest to him say he never had performed to a white audience. Now there's a little dispute about that, but I don't think he had. And, you know, times were changing, and these white British blues guitar people like Clapton and Peter Green from Fleetwood Mac and the Butterfield blues guys were really making a case for BB to break through. And so the first gigs that were scheduled, I think, ever in white clubs for BB King were in February of 1967 on the Sunset Strip. The original plan was to have him play at a club called Crescendo, which was, I think, a rhythm and jazz club.
Yeah, it was on, you know, La Brea, if I recall, just almost at sunset.
But given that it was a jazz club, of course, it had just closed, because jazz clubs always close. And so he was rescheduled to play at Gazzari's at Tahini and Sunset, which was a pop club that had, you know, hosted like The Doors probably like a month earlier. And our Mr. King did a 6-day residency at Gazzari's, and the LA Times covered it. And the critic on the 15th of February described his work as indescribably soulful. And I doubt the critic had ever heard him before, because very few white Americans had ever heard BB King at that point. But he played for 6 days at Gazzari's, and that was his breakthrough. People don't know this because everybody talks about the Fillmore, which happened like a week later in San Francisco.
We're going to take a break, come back with Daniel DeVise, author of King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. But let's go to the break with B.B.'s 1965 iconic performance at Chicago's Regal Theater, Sweet Little Angel.
I love the way she spread her wings. God's got a sweet little angel. I love the way she spread her wings. God, when she spread her wings around me, I get joy.
The voice of BB King. We'll talk about him more coming up on Air Talk. Very well chosen song for B.B. King's appearance at the Cook County Jail in Chicago, fall of 1970, which produced a highly memorable album, Every Day I Have the Blues, of course. The performance there, we're talking with Daniel DeVise, author of the new biography, King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. Daniel, you actually open with the scene of that performance at the Cook County Jail. How important was this in the body of work, the tens of thousands of performances in B.B.'s career?
Oh, man, there's a lot to unpack with that show. First of all, there's this trio of great live albums that he did. And most people know the Regal one, which was recorded in 64. That's the one that kind of introduced him as a guitar god, dare I say, the guitar god, who became the source of the sound, the guitar sound that was the lead guitar sound that dominated from the late 60s on. This is, if you remember Nigel Tufnel from Spinal Tap,
yes.
That is B.B. King's sound. It is his alone. And that is the record, that Regal record, where he kind of introduced that sound to white British and then white American guitar players. Okay, album number two is called Blues is King. It was recorded in Chicago like a couple years later, I think in late 66. Real blues connoisseurs actually think that's a better record. And I would very strongly urge anyone who's remotely interested to seek it out. It's a breakup record. He just divorced Sue, who we were just talking about. And he pours his heart out in that record. And then the one at the jail is the third. It makes the set. I mean, you could do a lot worse than buying those three records. The interesting little side note, I wrote something for Airmail, you know, the publication about this, that in his early years, B.B. was known primarily as a blues singer, not as a guitarist. This is partly the identity he had in the black community, and partly it was because the guitar itself wasn't hugely prominent in the, you know, in 1949 when B.B. got his start recording. It became big after Chuck Berry, after we get into the British invasion and all these boys with guitar bands. But in the 50s, the guitar was not king. And so B.B. was introduced time and time again on the Chitlin circuit as the world's greatest blues singer. And it's just kind of bizarre, to wrap your brain around that idea. And so here we have 1970. He's playing in Cook County to a primarily black audience. And he's introduced again as, ladies and gentlemen, the world's greatest blues singer.
We're talking about B.B. King with Daniel DeVise, author of King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. We have listener Doug in Venice, who emailed us at atcomments@kpcc.org. I saw B.B. King in Washington, D.C. in 1969. After his warm-up band, he came out, played one note. A shout went up from the crowd. He had us all with one note. The night was his. My most memorable concert moment, which of course is 50 some years ago. That's Doug in Venice remembering that performance by B.B. King. If you want to ask a question of our guest, Daniel DeVise, author of King of the Blues. Daniel, let's listen to another performance of B.B. King. This goes back to the Regal Theater, 1965, a show that was cut into a live album, and B.B.'s performance, How Blue Can You Get?
You said I want a Cadillac. I bought you a $10 dinner. You said thanks for the snack. I let you live in my penthouse. You said it was just a shack. I gave you 7 children.
Daniel, such a distinctive voice, such a powerful voice. And how was he able to do this for so many years and continue to do all these one-night stands?
Well, I guess one of the biographer's jobs is to try to figure out what makes your subject tick. And I'm going to grossly oversimplify here, but his father, B.B. King's father, Albert, not to be confused with
not
the guitar
to be confused
great.
With the other Albert King, yeah.
Who claimed to be his brother, but that's another story. BB's father was a workaholic. He'd risen to the top as a tractor driver on, you know, in whatever farm he was working at outside of Lexington, Mississippi. And he was the alpha male, the provider. His famous quote that BB repeated over and over was, "How can a man work too much? You know, there's no such thing." And BB lived that maxim his whole life. He stayed on the road. He was relentless. He did not take days off. He did not take weeks off. When he toured with U2, he was at loose ends because U2 would play like three gigs and then have three nights off. And BB wasn't used to that. He didn't know what to do. He was a workaholic and literally worked until he dropped. I mean, he was pretty much, you know, rolled off stage at the House of Blues in Chicago in 2014. That was his last show. And he died just months later.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us to talk about King of the Blues, the rise and reign of B.B. King, Daniel DeVise, as we conclude with 3 o'clock blues from B.B.'s 1957 recording of Singing the Blues. Satisfied. Author and Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Daniel DeVise on his recent book King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. Thanks for joining us for the weekend edition of the L.A. Report. Suzanne Watley and Nick Roman are back on Monday with the AM and PM weekday editions. And as always, you can catch me on Air Talk every weekday at 10 and Film Week Fridays at 11. Until then, be safe, have a great weekend. I'm Larry Mantle.
And she could be jiving too. Hey, nobody loves me but my mother.
This program is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.